Today is February the 14th, 2018. It's Ash Wednesday, a day of fasting, and it is the first day of Lent in Western Christianity. It is computed using an algorithm based on the ecclesiastic rules and tables of the 1582 Gregorian calendar reform. Well, exactly what is the algorithm? Let me find my abacus. It's also Valentine's Day. If you haven't sent out that special message, go online and select an appropriate passage from Sonnet 43 by Elizabeth Barrett Browning for someone special. And a shout out from us to all our listeners. You are special to us. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of All Things Computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcast of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI FM 99.5 on the radio and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program. However, tonight WBAI is in a membership drive, so the program is a little different. The 9/11 Emergency Service Fee provides funding for the operation of 9/11 emergency telecommunication services in your area. Emergency personnel must have the capability to identify the location of a caller when they dial 911. The fee, which is applied per access line, funds communication systems that support emergency and quick response for the police, fire, and ambulance services with identification of the phone number and the location of the call. Customers pay for this service and other 9/11 communication costs through state and county 9/11 surcharges. Not all counties have 9/11 systems yet, but may collect for future implementation. Two members of the Federal Communications Commission, one is a Democrat, one is Republican, so it's bipartisan, want to stop states from using 9/11 funds to pay for other government services or equipment. On our individual phone bills, a line item is typically included for 9/11 service. It's a relatively small fee that states and localities charge to support emergency calling services. But too many states are stealing these funds and using them for other purposes like filling budget gaps, purchasing vehicles, or worse. The FCC latest annual report on 9/11 fees covering calendar year 2016 said that New Mexico, Rhode Island, Illinois, New Jersey, and West Virginia have been diverting 9/11 funds, which totals almost $130 million. Besides those five states, another seven didn't even bother to respond. So there's a heck of a lot more money that's being diverted. New York is one state that did not submit a report to the FCC data collection, but sufficient public record information exists to support a finding that New York has been diverting funds for non-public safety use. 9/11 fees are applied to landline and wireless phone plans via monthly bills. The fees range by state. In six states that diverted funds in 2016, the monthly fees range from as low as 51 cents to $6.40 per monthly bill. This is according to the National Emergency Number Association. Within some states, the fees can vary by county or city, and that $6.40 charge is only applied in parts of West Virginia, while fees are as low as 98 cents elsewhere in that state. For example, Chicago has a monthly fee of $3.90, while other parts of Chicago pay only 87 cents. The FCC, with its jurisdiction over interstate communications, has the right to bar diverting states from imposing 9/11 fees on interstate calls. In addition to commission options, Congress has full ability to correct diversion of states' practices either by directly applying existing law or by exerting necessary leverage via its extensive grants and funding programs. Many of the funds that are allocated for specific use are diverted for other uses. And when they run out of money, they come back and say, oh, we have to raise the cost because it was insufficient funding. Hey, if you start using those funds for not the purposes it was intended for, of course you don't have sufficient funds. We have to stop this. Now, we have these two FCC commissioners that are trying to stop it. You should write to your congressmen, your legislative leaders, and say, we are in support of these two FCC commissioners. Do your job. make sure the funds are not diverted. And if they're going to be diverted, then the funds should not even be taken or tacked onto a bill. On Sunday, February the 4th, the world was watching the Philadelphia Eagles defeat the New England Patriots to win Super Bowl 52. Verizon and Samsung conducted some under-the-radar testing of the 5G network, and the results were impressive, as we're told. Three things in particular should stand out about the successful test. 5G-ready hardware was involved. For the test, Samsung said it developed 5G tablets that were able to deliver multi-gigabyte per second speeds on 5G and top 4G LTE speeds and proper switching between 5G and 4G networks. In addition to this, because of the fact that multiple carriers were involved, additional hardware was needed, including 28 gigahertz 5G access units and home routers, which means that the consumer-ready products are close to being ready. Multiple cities were involved in the test. Verizon using an area within the U.S. Bank Stadium in Minneapolis where the Super Bowl was being played was able to make a 5G video call to Seoul, South Korea. Additionally, to display the possibilities of extremely high bandwidth and low latency that 5G will offer, Verizon streamed live 180-degree stereoscopic video from the field in Minneapolis to virtual reality headsets in New York City. That demo reportedly required multiple 4K and HD video streams over their 5G network. Verizon was able to stream multiple 4K and high-def video feeds over their 5G network to virtual reality headsets in a different city. With the International Video Call, it was described as the first ever 5G video call on prototype 5G tablets, and the call was completed in high quality with no disruption. Oh yes, the Super Bowl Sunday saw a big win for Philadelphia Eagles, winning 41-33. Testing will continue at the Winter Olympics. Microsoft Office is no longer a one-size-fits-all office suite. There's Office 2016 and Office 365 for Windows and Mac OS personal computers. There's also now Office on the iPhone, Office on the iPad, and Office on Android smartphones. Office 2016 is a standalone, one-time purchase product, whereas Office 365 is the monthly subscription rental service that was released in 2011. Microsoft Office is currently free on smartphones and tablets. Office 2016 is a standalone. That purchase, actually, of a license to legally run the software gives the buyer the right to use Office 2016. In other words, the license has no expiration date, and users may run the suite as long as they want. Pay for Office 2016 this year and use it till whenever. Office 365, which is what Microsoft is pushing most aggressively, is a subscription service, so payments are made monthly or annually. A license for Office then is contingent on sustained payments. Halt the latter and the license is revoked. Restarting the payments restores the license. Microsoft will soon announce Office 2019 or 2020, and Office 365 would be supported only on Windows 10. The new policies means that Windows 10 is the only supported edition of Office OS as of January 14, 2020. In other words, Office 365 subscribers running Windows personal computers may have less than 2 years to upgrade to Windows 10. And if they're to continue working with a suite, they have to do it by subscription. Since the 2000, there has been Office 2000, XP, 2003, 2007, 2010, and 2013. Each of these versions introduced new improvements. As we previously stated, most of you will find basic document functions in earlier versions prior to Office 2016 have been more than adequate for your basic document functions, and they are operable with Windows 10 as well. Hey, there's an old saying we have. If it works for you and you have no other additional needs, just keep it. It's not broken, and you have it, and you don't have to pay any more for it. Now, what about the Office 2016 and up? Well, improvements have been made in each release of Office, and with 2016 and future Office versions, the improvements have been in co-authoring in Word, PowerPoint, and OneNote. In other words, the ability for a group of people to share the work on the same document. They have included Skype offering HD video, meaning high-definition video, desktop sharing, and also co-authoring presentations. A major update on Outlook 2016 includes fast search and removing low-priority mail. The addition of information rights management has also been included to help you encrypt your data online and off. If you're running a business, you'll probably need some of these improvements, but for personal computing, you'll probably keep what you have. Not broken, keep it, it works. The internet is the Wild West in terms of scams and spam and phishing and just about any kind of deception there is in how merchandise is sold, how mail is sent. You have to be on the watch out for anything that goes wrong. What's been happening now is that merchandise has now been shipped from Amazon without any return address. You may be one of the recipients. You didn't order the product. The scam is known as brushing. An online seller, usually overseas, purchases their own products through fake buyer accounts that they've created, and normally with accounts that they have gotten from prior purchases. The products are shipped to a real address, then the seller writes a positive review of their item from the fake buyer's account. The actual item shipped to you, in many cases, is often junk merchandise. Experts says this type of scam is called brushing. Vendors pay someone to purchase a product and ship it to a real address and write positive reviews. Now, positive reviews are like gold. People are always looking for reviews before they buy a product, and many of people now who are doing this brushing have found a new hole in the structure of Amazon to be able to put out more fake positive reviews. Amazon said they investigated every report of customer receiving unsolicited packages and will ban all vendors and reviewers who abuse the review system. Getting something in the mail may sound awesome and you may feel like you're getting something for free in the mail, but the problem is basically a brushing firm somehow got a hold of your name and address, compare prices, and mimic everything on what an actual customer would do before finally making a purchase from their client's store. When delivery is confirmed, they then leave positive reviews that an excellent product verified by you. The scam allows the retailers to fake both sales figures and positive reviews. This is a big deal for sellers on e-commerce sites who want to appear near the top of the site's ranking in order to boost legitimate sales. However, if you're the recipient of this merchandise without return address, you're not getting something for nothing. If anything, you've been highlighted as a candidate or you've been highlighted as someone that they will use to promote their brushing. And the products that may be sent to you, in most cases, will be just junk mail, and you have to get rid of it. Or, well, you'll probably get rid of it, but now it's up to you to say, hey, wait a minute, get this to stop. Contact Amazon. Remember a few months ago when an Apple engineer casually posted an internal HomePod build that contains plenty of iPhone X secrets? That was Apple's most significant leak in history, until this week, when someone shared the source code for a key piece of the iPhone core software called iBoot. That's the code that runs on the iPhone before iOS gets started, and whose secrets Apple has never shared with anyone. It's unclear how it ended up on GitHub, but the iBoot source code leak is now being called the biggest leak in history. And this leak itself is really a big deal that the iBoot code got out. iBoot is the one component Apple has been holding on to, still encrypting its 64-bit image, and now it's wide open in source code form. The code appears to be real, according to those who have done reverse engineering on it. Even though the leaked iBoot code is from iOS 9, it may still be relevant to security researchers and hackers looking for holes in Apple's mobile operating system. Apple has not confirmed the authenticity of the leak. Any iBoot vulnerabilities discovered could lead to new jailbreaks and even ways to decrypt the iPhone. The leak could also allow hackers to emulate iOS on non-Apple platforms. The vulnerabilities inside previous versions of iBoot allowed hackers to brute force their way into older iPhone models by circumventing lock screen protection. However, that's no longer possible on new devices that have a secure enclave processor on board. The iBoot leak could bring back tethered jailbreaks too, the kind that require the phone to be connected to a computer when booting. Who makes the most reliable hard disk drives? Which is a data center, released its updated yearly report on hard drive failures and performance, which means it's time to spin the wheel of hard drives and see where the recommendations land. The data set is drawn from Backblaze's own backup service and usage. While it's not a perfect stand-in for consumer workloads, it offers better predictability than any other publicly available resources. Backblaze only includes hard disk drives in its report, in which they have at least 45 drives of that type, and it currently has over 93,000 hard drives in operation. In their study, what they have shown that in the 8 terabyte to 12 terabyte range, Seagate has been the most reliable in the last 3 years. In each of the 3 years, from 2015 to 2017, the failure rates have dropped steadily, so that it's now under 1% failure for drives in operations in that period of time. However, in the 4 to 6 terabyte range, the most reliable drives have been the Western Digital drives, which registered under 1% failure over the last 3 years of usage. What does it mean? Well, in terms of enterprise, the higher the disk capacity which is used, the Seagate is the drive of preference, and in the consumer market, in which most people have 3 or 4, but in that range of hard disk drives, Western Digital has the edge. Generally speaking, the higher the total number of drives installed of a given model number, the better the chance that the data itself is accurate. They traced several of these drives for more than a year. It's safe to assume that the data itself is quite reliable. Amazon has an offering called Prime Exclusive Phone, in which the owner can pay a one-time fee of $45 to have ads removed from the lock screen of their devices. Amazon offers an opt-out feature to Prime Exclusive Phone and Kindle buyers, so they won't be bothered by ads and promotions flashed on the lock screen of their devices. The feature has a one-time fee. There were users who chose to pay for this option. Amazon has now decided to not charge for this. Well, what about those who paid the fee? Amazon is refunding the owners of Prime Exclusive phones who paid the fee. The move comes a week after the company announced it will officially remove lock screen ads from its phones. To prevent complaints, Amazon will refund Prime Exclusive phone owners. However, the company is not doing this with the use of real money. The firm is sending out gift cards to those who paid for the opt-out feature. So, therefore, users will only be able to redeem their refunds by, of course, purchasing eligible products on the Amazon store. They said, "We wanted to provide you with an important update about Prime Exclusive phones. Starting February 6th, which was last week, we began rolling out an Amazon offer app update to disable lock screen offers and ads on Prime Exclusive phones. Because you paid to unsubscribe from lock screen offers and ads, we will apply an Amazon.com gift card to your Amazon account for the same amount you paid. You can expect to see this applied to your Amazon account in 2-3 business days. Meanwhile, Prime Exclusive phones will continue to be sold at discounted rates
for Prime members. However, because the lock screen promos will no longer be present, Amazon has decided to add $20 to the price of all devices sold through this program. Previously, customers received low prices from Prime exclusive phones supported by lock screen offers and ads. With this change, existing Prime exclusive phone customers will have the offers and ads removed for no additional charge. However, there's a $20 price adjustment that will be added to the phones, which will still include, well, a sort of a discount off the list price available for the Prime members. There is no charge for blocking out ads, but there will be an increase in the offering. Well, now wait a minute. It sounds like a misdirection. There will not be a charge of $45 to have the ads blocked, but there's an increase in price of $20 for Prime exclusive phones. When will Amazon start offering a special on three-card Monty?
When people buy a product, they look at different reviews and they look at recommendations. And what has happened, which is a very rare instance, is when the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA, they all agree that there's a certain product you should stay away from. That's most unusual because they deal with intelligence. In the age of fake news, collusion, coercion, and just about everything else, all three of these intelligence agencies all agree on one thing. Don't buy Huawei phones. That's Huawei. The impact on you at the home is that the intelligence community has been warning about the risk of Huawei for years, but the timing of the message here is clear. Ever since the 2012 investigative report in which Huawei was wholly uncooperative, lawmakers have been warning about the potential dangers of using Huawei phones, but with the company on the verge of a U.S. breakout, the rhetoric has been ramped up considerably. Even without any hard evidence, the intelligence community has ample reason to suspect Huawei of cyber espionage, and it's stopping at nothing to ensure that the phone doesn't sell in the United States. While Huawei wasn't specifically targeted by the officials in their prepared statements, the Senate Intelligence Committee chairman steered the conversation to China, where he stated, "The focus of my concern today is China, and specifically China telecoms companies like Huawei and ZTE are widely understood to have extraordinary ties to the Chinese government." The Huawei phone, according to many people who have reviewed it, is a great phone and with a great camera, but the U.S. officials fear it may be used to spy on users. ZTE is a small player in the smartphone industry, but Huawei is number two or number three phone maker in the world and has been trying very hard to break into the U.S. market for years. They headed into the Consumer Electronics Show, and it seemed though it had finally gained a foothold with the U.S. carrier, but AT&T finally pulled out the last minute after pressure from a bipartisan group of lawmakers. So what are we going to make of it? Well, if we're warned by our intelligence agencies, let's take heed to it. Eight years ago, it was an aggressive move when Google started pushing its popular Gmail service over an encrypted connection by default. 4 years ago, it was a bit less surprising when it made encryption the only option for Gmail, and now it's taking the next step in trying to curtail eavesdropping, using its Chrome browser to label as not secure any website that's not encrypted. This move will fulfill a promise, well, maybe more of a threat, that Google made 3 years ago. The company said the day will be coming, told website publishers and Chrome users the deadline is the release of Chrome 68 in July. This is how Chrome will warn you about unencrypted websites, starting with version 68. In the early days of the internet, encryption required more powerful computing hardware, it slowed down communications, and it required websites to pay for expensive encryption certificates. But those performance problems are largely gone, and efforts like "Let's encrypt now and make the certificates free." And there's good reason to add the encryption. Obviously, you need it if you're typing your password into a website.
That's where Chrome first started offering its warning a year ago. But even with seemingly ordinary websites where you might not think you have anything to hide, encryption is a good idea. For one thing, encryption keeps malicious actors from messing around with web pages. For example, inserting ads or altering websites to send you to a bogus sign-in page. For another, looking at particular news stories or Wikipedia pages, which can reveal personal information to advertisers or, in some parts of the world, political surveillance agents. Encryption makes life a lot harder for authorities accustomed to the old days when they could wiretap phones and simply record conversations. FBI Director Christopher Wray rallied against unbreakable encryption, a common refrain among politicians and law enforcement officials. The only problem with such requests is that there's no way to make encryption breakable for legitimate investigations without breaking in for logging into websites. And for that reason, Silicon Valley companies have steadfastly maintained opposition to weakening of encryption. Other browsers are pushing encryption with measures similar to Chrome, and they're also pushing website developers by offering some new web technology only when websites are encrypted. Encryption is now ordinary. According to Firefox statistics, 70% of website visits now are encrypted, up from 28% 3 years ago. Google is offering tips to web developers who have to wrestle with the transition. According to Google measurements, 81 of the top 100 websites today encrypt websites by default. More than 68% of the traffic on Chrome for Android and Windows is now encrypted, and the figure is even higher, 78% for laptops running Apple Mac OS and Google's Chrome OS. Developers have been transitioning their sites to HTTPS, and that's a good thing. LED is now the lighting technology replacing incandescent and fluorescent. These days, you can get some of these super bright LED lights. They're cheap and they last a long time. The conversion has many people, however, scratching their head as to what lumens equate to in terms of wattage. The study of light is really old. Back in the days, they didn't use fancy LED lights or measure stuff with computers. No, they just used candles. In fact, the unit of lumen comes from a candle. Yes, an actual candle. Technically, it's from a standard candle, which is a candle that produces a flame of particular reproducible brightness. As a candle makes light, it spreads out and decreases in intensity, and if you were to integrate the intensity over a whole sphere surrounding a candle, you would get the total output, technically called the luminous flux, which sounds pretty cool. One candle would have a brightness of about 4 lumens. So let's get to the chase. If I wanted a 60-watt bulb, what should I look for? The answer is 800 lumens. Well, what about a 40-watt bulb? Well, it's 450 lumens. As you can see, it's not linear. So you have to be careful on how things are measured.
This evening, we have feature segments for Wearable and Tech Technologies by Dr. Alfred Poor, Smart Thermometers Track the Flu, Smart Pill Analyzes Stomach Gases, and Smart Monitors Saved Hospitals $100 million in 2017. Hey, did they drop the price on the bills that we get from the hospital? From the Tech Corner, I will be talking about special message alert that freezes your screen regarding notification of system crash. Yeah, they're not real, but we'll talk about it. And on the home automation front, Marty Winston talks about kitchen tech with home advisor smartphone strategist Dave DeClerico.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider. One of the big hot issues in this country today, and to some extent around the world, is the opioid epidemic. People are abusing, overusing pain medications, and it's creating lots of problems, ruining lives. It is an enormous issue. And as a result, it's really no surprise that many people are rethinking our dependence on medications, having to take a pill to solve whatever problem you might have. We're looking for more non-medicinal solutions to problems, and one of the key ones, of course, is pain. Well, there are a lot of alternative products out there that address some of this, and they have good science behind them. It's not all just sort of smoke and mirrors. One of the big categories is technology called TENS, T-E-N-S, and what that does is sends a slight electrical charge through your skin that stimulates a nerve and actually helps block the pain signals going to your brain. Another kind of product that's out there is a thing called Actipatch, A-C-T-I-P-A-T-C-H, Actipatch. It uses a totally different kind of non-chemical technology to address pain. What it has is a circular loop that is used to transmit electromagnetic pulses. What you do is you put the circle around your the area of your body where the pain is, and the electromagnetic pulses will then disrupt the pain sensors in that part of your body. It doesn't affect your whole body like TENS does, and there's no direct contact with electrodes to your skin, so it's not sending electrical current into your skin the way of TENS does. So there's no tingling, and apparently it's safe to wear for hours at a time. The company just today released the results of a double-blind test that they did. They had two groups. One received a placebo, in other words, a device that wasn't turned on, and the other ones received the pain-canceling device. And the researchers who were doing the testing didn't know who was getting which one. So that's why they call it double-blind. And the results came back clearly showing that those who had the device that was working had a reduction in pain. Those who didn't have the device showed much less pain reduction. So there's some evidence that this thing works. The interesting thing is that it's available over the counter, cleared by the FDA for sale at retail. It looks like it works and looks like it can provide a viable alternative for some people to taking pain medication. If you're a fan of Star Trek, then you remember the device that Dr. McCoy had that he could just wave over your body and it would find what's wrong. It could diagnose you with a non-invasive, no-contact kind of procedure. Well, this is something that we're looking for in the current reality. And one of the most intriguing ways of diagnosing potential disease is through breath samples. Now, your breath goes down into your lungs, which gets exposed to many of the chemicals that are in your body, natural or otherwise. And the key is sampling that breath and finding those tiny, tiny amounts of the different chemicals. Well, there's a company that has created a handheld device that is as good as what we would call the gold standard analysis of gas samples. The way it works is it sends an electrical charge through the sample, and this causes the ions, the different chemicals, to actually migrate, and so that the ions of the same chemical will cluster together at different points within the sensors, and then those can be measured and identified and so forth. It's a company called BreathTech Biomedical from Vancouver in Canada. The interesting thing about this, they've run tests against results from a gas spectrometer, which is the gold standard. That's the lab equipment that you would use for this kind of analysis. And they've discovered that the results from their device correlate very well with the results of the large formal gas spectrometer. So if this works out, if they can develop this product and turn it into an affordable, reliable device, it could transform how we test for different kinds of diseases, possibly even cancer, simply by having a patient blow into this device and having it sample their breath, looking for the biomarkers that would indicate different kinds of disease. Another area where we're looking for better ways to sample and identify biomarker levels within the body is diabetes. It's a worldwide epidemic. It costs billions of dollars a year in healthcare costs and has complications that ruin people's lives that can even be fatal. And so anything we can do to improve the treatment and maintenance of diabetes could be a huge savings for everybody. We've heard over the years a number of people who've been trying to develop a way to measure your glucose level based on your tears rather than having to sample your blood. And one of the ways that they've been going about this is to actually create a smart contact lens that could measure glucose levels and report them so you wouldn't have to do a finger stick in order to measure the blood sugar level. A team of Korean researchers at two universities there have been working on the problem. Some of the original attempts ran into difficulty because they had to use relatively large and rigid semiconductor components that would make up the sensors, the wireless transmitters, and so forth. And these would block vision. It would make the contact lens rigid. It would create hard spots and basically was not a good solution. Well, these researchers have come up with a way to use nanostructured material to create transparent conductors and semiconductor components for the sensors and the wireless transmitters and all. These are flexible, they're stretchable, and so they've been able to incorporate them into a soft contact lens. It doesn't obscure vision and is much more comfortable to wear. Now, we've got a long way to go before this becomes a real product, but would be great if in the future monitoring your glucose levels would be as simple as just sticking a contact lens in your eye. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. You're on the internet looking at a web page. For some reason, a message pops up and the screen itself is frozen. You can't seem to take any action at this point. The message on the screen is you have had a system crash or there has been an operating system malfunction. Call the following number for assistance. Con artists pushing a tech support scams have an arsenal of ways to lock up the browsers. A researcher disclosed a new weapon that freezes Google Chrome only and not the other browsers. Chrome is probably the internet's most widely used browser. The browser is unusable immediately after it displays a fake error message reporting some sort of security breach. Given the appearance of a serious crash that can't be fixed simply by exiting the site, end users are more likely to be worked into a panic and call the phone number included in the warning. Once called, the scammers, posing as representatives from Microsoft or any other legitimate company, stand a better chance of tricking the caller into providing a credit card number in return for tech support to fix the non-existent security problem. The scams are often transmitted through malicious advertisements or legitimate sites that have been hacked. A new technique was reported by security provider Malwarebytes, which works against Chrome by abusing the programming interface. By combining the API with other functions, the scammers force the browser to save a file to disk over and over and over again at intervals so fast it's impossible to see what's happening. Within 5 to 10 seconds, the browser becomes completely unresponsive. To recover, people on Windows machines generally use the Windows Task Manager to terminate the browser processes. After a period of inactivity, Mac OS users will show Chrome users a system message reporting that the open browser tab has become unresponsive and give the user the option to close it. This is generally a more attractive option than the one available to the Windows user because it involves closing only the abusive page. Manually shutting down the entire browser runs the risk of losing any unsaved work contained in any open Windows. This malware is Chrome-specific. However, other tricks will be used for Firefox, Internet Explorer, or Edge based on user agent string. A Google representative said that they are aware of the issue and they're working on a longer-term solution to address it. Bug reports have been filed. The most important thing to remember when encountering one of these windows is to not panic at all and to never call the phone number displayed in the warnings. When all else fails, the browser can almost always be unlocked by using the Windows Task Manager, which is Control-Alt-Delete, or the Mac OS Force Quit feature, which is the Apple menu.
You know, You know, our cybernetic house design really doesn't include any major stunts for the kitchen. There are a few things elsewhere in the house that are camera candy there for the effect and to help raise interest, but the kitchen doesn't get very much. Yes, we want to remote read cooktop temperatures to automatically turn a vent fan on and off at optimal moments. Yes, we want to turn off every fan and everything that burns or cooks or heats if there's a fire. And yes, we have some very specific ideas about LED lighting. Get into some of those in a minute, specifically in the pantry. Now, most of our kitchen attention is on choosing appliances and other elements that we can anticipate assisting our goal of being 40 years maintenance-free or our goal of being energy miserly. Now, as it happens, and this is entirely coincidental, at the same time everybody was at CES in Las Vegas, another everybody was at the Kitchen and Bath Industry Show, KBIS or KBIS in Orlando. For future reference and strictly a personal opinion, Orlando is the only city I know of that can make Las Vegas look less tacky. But this segment is about the cool gear at KBIS. Not my frosty sneer, just the cool gear. So you'll be hearing from an industry guy, Dave DeClerico. He has the title, Home Expert and Smart Home Strategist at Home Advisor. With luck, I won't try to sing that. He says the kitchen has been the last frontier for home technology, but he sees that changing quite quickly now. Now, understand, a major difference between Dave and me is that I tend to look for what's wrong now and try to figure out how to do it right, while he looks for what's right now and trumpets it, and that's fine. Now, three things at the show especially impressed him. One of them came from Samsung, and it's the first time Samsung has been at the KBIS show in 6 years. Now, we're not sure what inspired them to use communications as a new convenience hook. Samsung? Communications? Really? We're all for what they're doing with it. But you don't want to hear this from me. Dave?
The latest smart appliances we're seeing can actually talk to each other, which simplifies meal prep but can also make the home a safer place. For example, Samsung's new Bluetooth-enabled vent hood can be paired with a Samsung range so that anytime you turn on the cooktop, the ventilation automatically kicks in. The hood is equipped with heat sensors, so it will crank up the ventilation as temperatures on the cooking surface increase. That's going to control smoke and odors, as well as grease buildup, which can lead to cooking fires. You'll also be more likely to make it through the meal without the smoke alarm going off. And there's even an energy-saving angle here, since the hood will automatically shut down when you turn off the cooktop.
See, they're heading in a good direction. And they're not the only ones. Now think, Dave, didn't you see another company with a cooktop that could do tricks? Tell us about it.
The latest gas cooktop from Monogram, GE's luxury line, is another example of a safety-enhancing smart appliance. The cooktop will send an alert to your phone when a burner is left on longer than normal, say for that simmering pasta sauce that you forget to turn off before leaving the house.
Pasta sauce, huh? I need automation that'll keep me from burning the garlic bread. Truth be told, my wife is a much better cook than I am. She has more patience, she knows how to follow recipe directions, and she doesn't substitute or shortcut on ingredients. So Dave, was anything there for a shortcutting step skipper like me?
When it comes to sheer convenience, I like Whirlpool's scan-to-cook technology. It's available on microwaves and ranges. You simply scan the barcode on that frozen pizza box or microwave meal, and the appliance takes over from there, setting the correct time, power, and temperature, and even pinging you when it's done. That eliminates the guesswork and gets dinner to the table even faster.
And who doesn't like dinner faster? Dave DeClerico, everybody, the smartest guy on smart homes at Home Advisor. Now, I mentioned kitchen lighting, and in our cybernetic house, it's all LED fixtures, of course. If you remember what I've been saying about color temperature, anything that lights up food while it's being prepared needs to be at a color temperature of 4,000 to 5,000 degrees Kelvin. And that's because if the light is more amber, as it will be at lower color temperatures, people will tend to misjudge freshness and quality. I will grant that the degree of doneness is only slightly harder to judge at those lower color temperatures, but freshness, crispness, quality, the food you choose to make, those judgments depend on having a little more daylight in your view, the 4,000 and 5,000 K color temperatures. Brightness counts too. A classic 60-watt bulb produces 800 lumens. Kitchen lighting should provide at least 1,200 to 1,500 lumens. Think about the light of a classic 100 or 150-watt light bulb. That's 1,200 to 1,500 lumens. And yes, you'll want to be able to dim those lights for the times when you're not using the kitchen for food prep. Speaking of lights, there are two approaches to pursue inside the kitchen pantry. One is to place a light inside the pantry on the wall directly over the door. Over the door, inside, shining inward. Another, for larger pantries, is to run a linear light along the center of the ceiling, but shield it with an upside-down V-shape. The idea is to light up what's on the shelves without letting people directly view the emitters. That creates glare. Well, you could potentially use a warmer color temperature in the pantry. Don't. It's kind of spooky to see an almost candlelight white coming from a smaller space that's connected to a bigger, almost daylight white space. Another option for the pantry, light each shelf. There are small, about half-inch, rod-shaped LED fixtures made primarily for under-counter lighting that you can attach just under the front edge of each shelf, providing vivid lighting of the shelf below. And you really don't need light switches in a pantry. Spaces like pantries work well with fairly dumb automation, so you could use something like a passive infrared motion detector or even something like a magnetic open door sensing switch. Also, when you're using a Dolly, D-A-L-I, Dolly control system, there's still some elegant finesse on how you can get your lights to respond to everyday circumstances, even with those dumb sensors. While we're in the kitchen, I'd like to put in a plug for outlets. Are there ever enough of them? Take an extra position or two in the breaker box if you're wiring or remodeling to bring up more circuits that can support more convenience outlets. And everywhere you are going to put a pair of outlets in a single-gang electrical box, make it a three-gang box and put in six outlets. It's not about keeping everything plugged in all the time. It's about never needing to work in a few different places when you just don't have enough outlets to plug everything you need now at the place you want to work now. And we should dip into water. Professionals like to broadly class two types of water usage in a house: washing water and drinking water. Drinking water includes all the water you cook with, all the water that goes into your coffee or tea, the water that makes ice in your freezer, in short, water that passes through your lips. You can taste the way minerals or other imbalances in your drinking water change the flavor of everything that uses it. And even if you can't taste it, you have friends and family who can. There are point-of-use water purifiers that can help drinking water, but don't go there until you've done a whole house treatment of your washing water, because the results of that can change what you need for drinking water. Treatment, purification, whatever you're going to do with it, and that change probably will save you some money. Speaking of water in your kitchen, can you make a list of everywhere a water leak can happen? Here are a few. The plumbing pipes to your sink, hot and cold taps, to the refrigerator, ice and water convenience features, to the pot filler over the stove if you have one of those, to the dishwasher, and to everywhere the drains connect, sink, dishwasher, disposal, and the refrigerator's evaporator pan could overflow. Opinions vary on this, but I don't think it's useful to put water sensors in all those places. We'll get into that another time. Well, that's it for now. And just as I tell Hank, when there's any danger of his wife catching him reaching for the cookie jar, just back up, back up, back up. Back to you.
Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the tri-state area. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on online tools Friday, February the 16th, 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on voice-operated assistance, Thursday, February the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. They'll meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC Users Group will have their meeting February the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group will have their general meeting on Thursday, March the 1st. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains, New York. The Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, March the 6th, 7:30 p.m., Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on Thursday, March 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, March the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They'll meet at the New York Institute of Technology at Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they'll meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Shore Hall. The User Club meetings, by the way, are free and open to the public, and we hope to see you there. And a big festival is coming up. TCF 2018, the 43rd Annual Computer Festival. The theme of the festival is wearable technologies. The Trenton Computer Festival is an annual educational event with speakers, forums, and user group meetings, and an indoor flea market. Saturday, March the 17th, 2018, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the College of New Jersey. The website is tcf-nj.org for more information. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI, FM 99.5 New York on the radio and on WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening, and in this crazy weather we have, stay safe, stay healthy, until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.